Monday, May 16th, 7:44 a.m., Crescent Heights Middle School. Charles Philip Chip Moy could think of better places to be on the first day of finals week. It wasn't that he lacked in scholastic ability or enthusiasm. As a matter of fact, he was rather looking forward to finishing out his career at Crescent Heights Middle School on a high note, and had no particular fear that he would fail in that regard. He had no qualms about the faculty or the uniform that he had to wear, which, despite his lanky frame, he thought looked decent on him. Over the course of the school year, he'd become rather fond of the place, and thought, like everyone else, he'd be sorry to see the last of the place he moved on to, most likely, Friedrich Koopman Memorial High School in the following year. It was hardly an auspicious start to one's last week of school, however, to be shoved into one's locker. To make matters worse, the door was securely shut behind him and the voice override had been sabotaged. Fortunately, none of the lockers was airtight, so his situation was more humiliating than life-threatening. Sadly, as situations like his are wont to do, things got worse. His protests managed to draw a sizable crowd and absolutely no help. A few teenage boys wove through the crowd and knocked on his locker door. "Yeah?" he replied, his voice reverberating slightly. "How'd you end up in there?" a rather clueless-sounding boy's voice asked. Chip groaned. "Somebody thought that I was Houdini and decided to test me out," he joked sardonically. "Who's Houdini?" came the less-than-informed query. Nobody could see him roll his eyes in exasperation, but he did so anyway. "Never mind." "Don't you have anything else better to do?" a female voice exclaimed, presumably addressing the crowd. With some muttering, they mostly dispersed. "Are you okay, Chip?" It was his sister, Raina. "I've been better. Do you know my combination?" "Hang on." She rapidly typed in a series of digits, then exhaled noisily in disgust. "No good. They really messed with the lock. I don't have the tools to cut you out, so I guess I'll have to call the custodian."
"Mind if I try something?" a vaguely familiar male voice asked.
Sure. The sudden shift in the tone of his sister's voice drew Chip's attention. It wasn't often that Raina went in awe of someone, but that's what it sounded like. He heard a series of beeps, followed by the blessed sound of the lock disengaging. The locker door swung open, and he was helped out by two pairs of hands. Stretching, he got a good look at his savior. The savior in question was a bit older than Chip, with coal-black hair that diverged into improbably spiky forelocks. His ice-blue eyes held both a mixture of disgust at the prank played at Chip's expense and mild curiosity about the poor jerk who'd gotten stuffed into his locker. He was pocketing an electrolock confounder inside his uniform jacket.
"You okay?" he asked.
"Just peachy," Chip replied. "Remind me not to become a contortionist. Thanks. Hey, aren't you Corwin Ravenhair?"
"That's me," he confirmed.
"You're the guy that's going to be a god someday, right?" Chip continued.
Corwin put his hand behind his head and looked a bit awkward. Well, someday."
"In that case, isn't this where I pledge my undying fealty to you?" Chip joked.
Corwin looked suitably mortified.
"I'd rather you didn't." "Well, tough. You've got it anyway."
Chip then proceeded to bow at the waist in supplication, chanting, "I'm not worthy." Raina looked on, clearly amused by both her brother's antics and the discomfort that Corwin was experiencing.
"Okay, okay, cut it out," Corwin urged Chip, mock smiting him with one of his books. "Get to class already." "At once it shall be done, O mighty one."
Corwin sighed, rolled his eyes good-naturedly, and moved off down the hall in the opposite direction, returning Raina's farewell wave as she tugged her brother around a corner and down an adjoining corridor. He supposed it was an all-right sort of day for a Monday, but Corwin was somewhat preoccupied and found himself wishing Friday would come sooner. He liked school, and under normal circumstances he'd have been trying to savor his last week at Crescent Heights, which had been the site of many a happy time in the last 3 years. But the plans he had for his summer made him anxious to get started. The holder of a Starship Master's certificate, he had been recruited by his sister's prep school roommate, Utrina Tencho, to teach her the things she would need to know in order to pass the exam for her own master's cert. The examination, which covered such widely varying subjects as astrogation, hazard management, damage control and emergency repairs, flight maneuvering, communications protocol, interstellar shipping law, and elementary FTL physics, among other things, was widely reputed to be brutal. And Corwin, having experienced it the summer before, knew that reputation to be deserved. He was confident that Utrina could pass it, but he was also confident that it would take the two of them most of the summer to cover everything she would need to know in sufficient detail. He'd warned her up front, when she'd asked him to teach her, that she would have to take risks, work hard, and be prepared to get dirty. Which suited Utrina down to the ground anyway, since she was by nature a hoyden, boisterous, bold, and fearless almost to the point of foolhardiness. Throughout her life, she had encountered people who wanted her to slow down, quiet down, and be more ladylike. But Corwin, who had grown up surrounded by women such as the Valkyrie, thought she was just about damn near perfect the way she was. He'd known her for about 5 months, since Christmas time, and except for family, his sister Kate, his cousin Hiroshi, he was fully prepared to call her his best friend in the universe at this point. Damn, what a summer this was going to be. Sure, he'd have to crash on his mother's couch all summer, except for the excursions that lasted more than a day, exiled from his room so that Utrina could use it, but so what? A summer of high-speed adventure, Aunt Belle's cooking, mechanical tinkering, quiet evenings with games and long conversations, the wonders of the galaxy to explore. Bliss. But first he had to get through finals week. Corwin stopped walking suddenly and looked around. Where the hell was he going? He was nearly to the music department. Hadn't he been headed for Mr. Sulak's science classroom? Why was the hall so deserted? The bell rang. Oh. Corwin sighed, turned, and ran the other way. No running in the halls, Mr. Ravenhair. Mrs. Kelly, one of the standard literature teachers, admonished him in a sing-song voice from the doorway to her classroom. He slowed to a walk, giving her an apologetic salute, and she gave him a cautionary nod, went into her room, and shut the door behind her, at which point he broke into a run again. Fortunately, Mr. Sulak wasn't a particularly vindictive teacher. He was a Vulcan, after all. He simply assigned Corwin his rightful 2 demerits for tardiness, a bit meaningless in his last week at the school, but the rules are the rules, and left it at that, rather than demanding an explanation and or issuing a lecture on the importance of punctuality to the civilization of the galaxy. Mrs. Kelly would have given the lecture. Corwin was glad he didn't have her for a class this year. Nall Silverclaw, Corwin's cat-like companion, who claimed to be a white dragon, launched himself from his seat on the shoulder of a slightly disgruntled-looking brunette girl in the third row, and landed on Corwin's shoulder as he received his demerits. Corwin acknowledged his punishment gracefully and went to sit down next to the girl Nall had been with when he arrived. "As I was saying," said Mr. Sulak calmly, "today you will undergo the elementary hyperphysics practical exam phase. You will be performing a simple element transmutation experiment with the supercolliders. Please break up into your lab teams and set up your colliders on the lab tables." Corbin smiled. He liked collider experiments. He went to one of the lab tables in the back of the room. The girl Nall had been sitting with followed, as did a pleasant-faced blonde girl with glasses who had been sitting up front. "What happened to make you late, Mr. Corwin?" asked Fu Haoji, as Corwin set up their collider, a black polycarb box about the size of a big suitcase, with a disorienting tangle of wires surrounding a silver metal donut that filled most of the interior space, in the center of their slate-topped lab table. The little dragon ruffled his wings in irritation, refurled them against his back, and jumped up onto his lab partner's shoulder to observe the experiment.
"Nothing real exciting," said Corwin as he connected the collider's power input to the socket on the corner of the table.
"Wandering around in a rose-scented haze again?" the brunette wondered.
"No," Corwin snapped.
Nall turned to the green-eyed brunette and grinned.
"You believe him, Buttercup?"
"Nope," she replied, grinning back.
"Yeah, me neither." "You'd be more believable," Nall informed the young demigod, "if your ears didn't turn red when you said that."
"Shut up and help me calibrate the cyclotron, furball," growled Corwin. Fu merely smiled and started ruling out the experimental flowchart on a blank page of her notebook. By that Friday, the DSM construction site looked like a proper construction site. All the temporary buildings were up, the roadbeds were cut, and the building lots delineated. Excavators were working on the foundation holes for the Science Center and the Administration Building, formal names to be announced at the school's grand opening, while the surveyors finalized detail work at the other end. Down in Port Geradar, the infrastructure improvements were also proceeding apace. The spaceport was coming along nicely, its temporary control center and the first few light starship revetments already completed. It wasn't expected to be a very busy port, but given that the old shuttle station had pretty much comprised all of Gerardo's spaceport facilities, some expansion was called for. That Friday afternoon, the new spaceport got its first customer. The duelists were outside, enjoying a sunny afternoon and throwing debris into a dumpster thoughtfully provided by the Corps of Engineers when, with a low, leisurely scream of fusion turbines, a black wing shape darted across the horizon. It banked low over the duelist's castle, winging over so the sunlight glittered on its silver go-faster stripes, then rolled out and headed for Port Geradar.
"He certainly knows how to make an entrance,"
Chenan mused as several of the others waved at the receding shape.
"It's in his blood," said Utena offhandedly. She finished heaving a chunk of, whatever that was, plaster, maybe, into the dumpster, dusted off her hands, and said,
"Guess that means it's about time to get ready, huh, Kate?"
Kate took out her pocket watch, consulted it, then tucked it away in the watch pocket of her jeans again and nodded.
Just about, she said.
An hour later, the one-hit wonder departed from Port Geradar and docked aboard Babylon 5 in plenty of time. The Institute duelists, now decked out in formal garb, were conducted by a smartly dress-uniformed Lieutenant Reed to the Arboretum, where the station staff and crew were gathered, along with representatives of the Galaxy's press and the Pact Babylonica's signatories, for the station's opening ceremonies. For all that most of the galaxy didn't seem to think the station was a very good idea, its opening was a gala occasion all the same. Hundreds of beings were arranged on temporary seating in the green and pleasant setting of the Arboretum for the speeches, which were as dull as one might expect, and the ceremonial cutting of the ribbon, which was utterly meaningless in what had been an operational, if understaffed and purposeless, space station for almost a month. One by one, the ambassadors from the various major and minor powers which had sent representatives to Babylon 5 stepped up and made brief statements saying how honored they were to be part of this historic endeavor. In very few cases did they seem at all sincere. One of them in particular was met with a sharp intake of breath from one of the Gerardo contingent, though the content of his remarks had little to do with it.
"What's the matter?" Mia Ausa asked quietly.
Belana Torres leaned toward her and whispered urgently,
"Nobody told me there was going to be a Klingon ambassador."
"Well, of course. The Klingon Empire is one of the project's strongest supporters. Why? What's the matter?"
I can't let him see me.
What? Never mind. Don't worry, we're well away from the front. He won't notice you. When the ceremony's over, we'll figure something out.
Baylana nodded, but sat tense and nervous through the rest of the speeches, never taking her eyes off the side of the reviewing stand on which the Klingon ambassador sat. After the ambassadors had their say, International Police Organization Chief Ben Hutchins, Caton Corwin's father, known to most as Griffin, took the podium to give a short rundown of the IPO's mission and say how pleased he was to be involved with the Babylon Project. Then there was a little speech from the Babylon Foundation's founder, Megazone, which was, Utrina thought, disappointingly free of non-sequiturs. Somebody from the Bajoran government talked about how excited Bajor was to be hosting the Great Experiment. Then Griffin returned to the podium to introduce the station's command staff. In overall charge of the station was Commander Jared Johnson of the IPO Space Force, formerly a Wedge Defense Force officer and still on the rolls of that august organization's reserves. His deputy was Lieutenant Commander Susan Ivanova of the United Federation of Planets Starfleet. The station's Bajoran liaison officer, Major Kira Nerys, doubled as Chief of Security. Dr. Julian Bashir from Starfleet Medical had overall charge of the station's extensive medical facilities and looked as happy about it as a man could possibly look with all his clothes on. Rounding out the command staff was another man the duelists hadn't met before, in the black-jacketed dress uniform of the IPO Space Force. He looked to be in early middle age, with curly reddish hair, and seemed a bit nervous and uncomfortable. He kept fidgeting with the cuffs of his sleeves and the turtleneck collar of his green Service Division undershirt. Griffin introduced him as the station's chief engineer, Chief Warrant Officer Miles O'Brien. Griffin then introduced his IPO Space Force comrade, Captain Krontep Vathkesek of the Imperial Klingon battlecruiser Khoskaj, and the commanders of the starships that had assisted his own Challenger in joint defense operations until the station's defense grid was up and running, WDF Captains H.H. Hansen of the Renown and Edward Pellew of the Indefatigable, and CFMF Vice Admiral Ayami Nakajima and her staff. As he took back the podium, the IPO commander had a curious little smile on his face. "Some of you may know," he went on, "that we've had a bit of bureaucratic trouble getting the Wedge Defense Force on board as a Pact Babylonica signatory. They've been gracious enough to help us out with the station's defense during construction, but for a while there it didn't look like they were going to set up a formal liaison and participate in the project itself." His smile broadened as he went on. "Well, it turns out that it wasn't so much a misunderstanding as a deliberate stall. Field Marshal Ritchie has a unique sense of history. He wanted to see how many organizations and governments would come on board not knowing that the WDF was throwing its full support behind the project. And now that he knows that, he's willing to commit that support. So, at the last possible instant, please welcome our liaison officer from the Wedge Defense Force, Captain Derek Bacon." Applause washed over the reviewing stand as, from behind a nearby curtain, a very large man in the blue and white, double-breasted, brass-buttoned uniform of the Wedge Defense Force emerged, smiling and waving. At first sight of him, Utrina thought he must be a Hoffmanite, a heavy-gravity gene mod like her friend Moose McEachern. This man wasn't as tall as Moose, who was over 7 feet tall. He looked, in fact, about the same height as Megazone. But where Megazone was of impressive, imposing build, this man was massive, built like a bridge abutment. His uniform looked as if it might be having trouble containing him. He had a very round and very friendly face with a broad, open grin and extremely bright eyes. His sandy hair was shaved except for a strip about 2 inches wide in the center of his scalp, which was long enough to be drawn back into something like a Klingon warrior's queue at the back of his neck. Silver data jacks gleamed above his right ear. Derek Bacon strode to the podium, shook hands with Griffin, and then turned and spoke into the microphone. Utrina got another surprise at this. Just from the size of him and from his build's resemblance to that of Moose,
She'd expected Bacon to have a Hoffmanite's voice, too, deep and saturated, like an earthquake trying to talk. Instead, it was actually on the slightly high side of mid-range, the sort of voice that, had Utina closed her eyes, would have put her in mind of somebody built about like wiry Commander Johnson.
"Hey, hey, hey!" said Bacon. "How's everybody doing? Me? I'm great!"
"Kai the Captain!"
cried Krontep, and those members of his command staff with him joined in. Zarg Thalak had the distinct and particular look of a man who has just found something very, very unpleasant floating on top of a bowl of his favorite soup.
"I'm very excited to be part of this," said Bacon, his grin threatening to damage his face if it got any wider. "My only regret," he went on, "is that I won't be here full time, because this is going to be the place to be."
Zarg looked relieved. Dr. Bashir nodded in sage agreement with Bacon's sentiments as the Wedge Defender went on. "But I'll be in the neighborhood. Harry and Ed are heading home now that the station's online, but I'll be joining Griff and Krontep, keeping this place safe for democracy." Most of the attendees had no idea what the hell he meant by that, particularly. But they applauded anyway. The man's enthusiasm was infectious. "This concludes the official opening ceremonies," said Megazone. "Which means," he added dryly, "there are no more boring speeches to sit through, and you can have at the food." So they did. The duelists regrouped. Now that the ceremony had broken up into what was essentially a massive buffet gathering, Belana was growing more nervous by the minute, and something had to be done about it.
"Well, look, what are you afraid of?" Utina wondered. "I mean, I know Zarg's a big stiff, but he's mostly harmless."
"Not to me," Belana insisted. "Don't you get it? He's the Klingon ambassador. I'm a missing person under his jurisdiction. If he spots me and figures out who I am, he'll have to send me back to Kronos."
Utina considered saying, "I thought you weren't a Klingon," but discarded it as unproductive and overly snarky.
"You're a runaway?" said Jury, a little sharply. "What did you think, I was trying to get a job at a construction site on a Bajoran moon for a summer school project?" Belana shot back. Jury had to admit she had a point.
"Look, I don't have time to tell you my whole life story, okay? My mother's family on the homeworld have legal custody of me. They're really strict and really traditional. I mean, the full Cult of Kaelas treatment, all right? And I had to get out or I was going to go nuts. Or get killed. My uncle Clavor has a really weird idea of what builds character."
"What about your father?" asked Mia, who, as Belana told her abbreviated story, had grown more and more sympathetic-looking.
"Dead," said Belana. "Or he might as well be, as far as I'm concerned. I've got to get out of here."
Caitlin frowned thoughtfully.
"You're with us," she said finally. If you...
She sighed and looked at Utina.
"Kate's right," said Utina, picking up the thread without trouble. "If you go running off without one of us, security will pick you up, and then..."
"Hey, kids," said the friendly voice of Commander Jared Johnson, almost startling the concentrating little knot of duelists out of their skins. Belana looked about ready to try hiding behind Mia.
"Problem?
Not enjoying the party?"
"Oh, it's fine, Commander," said Utina. "It's just, Belana's not feeling well."
Belana's frightened expression took on an additional layer that basically said, "That lame excuse is the best you could think of," as she turned to look at Utina, who shrugged. Jer looked from Utina to the Klingon-looking girl and back, then turned and peered over the crowd to where a suffering-looking Zarg was being harangued by a cheery-looking Krontep in the buffet line. Then he turned back with a sly smile on his face.
"First, have a bunny," he said, and thrust the gray rabbit he was carrying into Belana's arms. Second? Give me a second. He tapped the call button on the communicator he wore in the back of his hand and said into it, Jared O'Brien. Go ahead, Commander, said an Irish brogued voice in response. Come here a minute. I've got a little job for you. On my way. A minute later, the curly-headed chief engineer worked his way out of the crowd and came up to the side of the group, looking interested. What's up, Commander? He asked. Chief O'Brien, everybody, Chief O'Brien, said Jer breezily. See the girl with the bunny? Take her down to Gray Sector and show her the toys or something. Don't let Ambassador Killjoy see her. Got it? O'Brien looked at Belana, then turned and glanced across the crowd at Zarg. I assume you mean Ambassador Tholak, he said with a wry grin. Yes, right, said Jer. Do a level 2 diagnostics on the defense grid or like that. You know, interesting stuff, not boring crap like the fusion reactors. You're excused from the rest of the shindig. Take as long as you like. O'Brien's grin became a lot less wry. Count on me, sir, he said. I always do, said Jer. He took his bunny back from Belana and indicated the chief engineer. The girl cast a nervous glance around, but the duelists were nodding and smiling, so she nodded herself, swallowed, and went with him. Thanks, said Utrina once the two had vanished through the bulkhead into the outer station. No problem, Jer replied, petting Bailey absently. I consider it part of my job to keep Zarg from ruining people's days as much as possible, he added with a grin. Come on, Bailey. Let's go see if JR left us anything in the salad bar. As soon as they were out of the arboretum, Chief O'Brien sighed, took off his dress uniform's jacket, and rolled his sleeves up to the elbows. Don't like formal occasions, huh? Asked Belana. O'Brien smiled sheepishly. Not particularly, he said. Part of the job sometimes, but I'd rather be seeing to my station. Sorry about getting dumped on you like that. I'll try to stay out of your way. Don't worry about it, said O'Brien. I'm Miles O'Brien, by the way. I didn't catch your name. Belana. Belana Torres. Well, Belana, as it happens, I've got a transporter pattern matrix in Red Sector Room 2 that needs recalibrating, if that won't bore you too much. Anything's better than going back to Kronos, she replied, trying out a faint grin. It seemed to feel all right, so she left it. I don't know anything about transporters, though. Well, that's all right. It's usually a solo job anyway, said O'Brien. You can just hand me tools and the like, okay? Okay. That was remarkably perceptive of Commander Johnson, Jury mused as she and Caitlin stood next to each other in the buffet line. Said Kate. I'm a little worried, though. Worried? What about? Given the fascination she's shown for construction and engineering, said Kate, I'm not sure we'll ever get Belana back. Jury chuckled. I'm sure Chief O'Brien will get tired of her eventually and send her on her way. So, said Krontep ebulliently, what is this mysterious assignment? You said you'd be taking over for Hansen and Pellew. Does that mean you have another command? Derek Bacon grinned. Yep, they're actually trusting me with a ship that crews more than a dozen, if you can imagine it. They gave me a station with a 250,000, said Jer, who now had a bunny on each shoulder, one working on a lettuce leaf, the other nibbling at his teal hair. But I expect running a space station is like being a system admin. 90% of the users just want to get on with their jobs. 10% want to play silly buggers and see what they can get away with. 10% of 250,000 is a lot of silly buggers, Krontep observed. Hmm, said Jer. But I've got good assistant admins, he added with a grin. I pity anybody who tries to put anything over on Ivanova and Kira. They'll fight over who gets to gnaw on the bones.
Well, don't keep us in suspense, Captain, said Krontep, nudging his old commander. What's your new command?
From Babylon 5, I'm John Trussell. Good night.
Okay. The flat voice of G3N3, the Network 23 field assistance droid who usually served as Truss's camera bot, announced, We're clear. The gray-painted droid lowered the big Net 23 ethercam rig and nodded his snouty head. Good show, boss.
Not bad at all, concurred the holographic image of Truss's machine intelligence controller, Al.
Thanks, said Truss wryly.
Okay, Jean, take the camera back to the ship and pack up for the night. We'll move into the office tomorrow.
Roger, roger, replied Jean, and he turned on his heel and marched away.
So now what? Asked Al as Truss started navigating through the crowd. The garishly dressed, middle-aged-looking image flowed through the crowd without bothering to move aside. Instead, he just walked through people. No one noticed him because no one else could see him. When Truss had first received the neural implant that permitted Al to enter his sphere of sensory input undetected by others, he'd found that effect extremely disconcerting. Now he was used to it, and the only thing he found disconcerting was Al's hideously garish virtual wardrobe. Now, said Truss, I'm going to find Mia, and you're going to go away and leave me alone. Al mock scowled. Okay, fine, he said. I know when I'm not wanted. With a harumph, he vanished. If only, Truss murmured, smiling. A few moments later, he located his target, sitting at one of the long buffet tables with the rest of the duelists. Is this a private table? He asked, smiling. Mia's face lit up. Dad! She cried, jumping up and enfolding him in her arms. I figured you might be here. Everyone, this is my father, John Trussell.
He looks somehow familiar, said Kyuichi Sionji dryly.
Yeah, concurred Wakaba Shinohara. I could swear I've seen him somewhere before.
I get that a lot, Truss replied. People say I look like somebody famous. Personally, I can't see the resemblance, he added.
Hey, O'Griff. Nice introduction you did there.
Griffin gave Derek Bacon a sardonic look. Bacon shrugged. Just trying to say something nice, he said with a grin.
Hey, got a minute? You were out on patrol and missed most of the diplomatic arrivals. Let me introduce you to some of the ambassadors.
Sure, said Griffin with a faint, enigmatic smile. The crowd had thinned out considerably in the hour since the buffet opened, and locating diplomatic personnel was not difficult. The first ambassador they found was especially easy to find, since he was standing at the corner of the wet bar with Megazone, carrying on a rather loud, rather lubricated conversation.
"Keeps your hair up like that anyway," Zoner was asking as Griffin and Derek approached.
"The thought of my wives!" replied the other, a rather portly man in a very ornate purple jacket, and sporting the usual outlandish Centauri hairdo that looked rather like a black peacock fan.
"Excuse me," said Derek. "Ambassador, I'd like to introduce you to the chief of the International Police."
The Centauri turned, focused his drink-brightened eyes on the IPO chief, then grinned broadly and flung his arms open.
"Griffin!"
he declared, clapping the one he named firmly on both shoulders.
"Friend Griffin, how are you? It has been years! You have come up in the world, I see, while I..."
He shrugged eloquently, leaned forward, and said in a tone of broad confidentiality,
"Londo Molari, my friend, is, like his empire, in a definite state of decline."
"You're looking fine to me, Londo," Griffin lied with a smile.
a little drunk, but then you did some of your best flying a little drunk.
Ah, no, there you are wrong, my friend. I did my best flying when I was a lot drunk.
Mallory laughed uproariously.
And with the help of my dear and good friend Megazone, that is what I intend to be in another hour or so.
Griffin glanced at Zoner. Zoner shrugged with a, well, what can I do, expression. Well, I'll leave you to it then, said Griffin. We'll have to have lunch sometime.
I would enjoy that,
said Mallory with the extra careful enunciation of the inebriated.
Just so long as you are buying.
That struck him as very funny, and he let out another great peal of laughter before turning back to his drink. Griffin shook his head as he and Derek moved away. Poor bastard, he muttered. Didn't know you knew him, said Derek. Yeah, it was a long time ago, back in the exile. I was first mate in his trading ship for a while. He was a bit of a pirate back in those days. When we parted ways, back in 38, he was heading back to Centauri Prime to clean up his act and try to get into a respectable line of work. Griffin sighed, shrugging. Well, it looks like he got it. Derek nodded. Well, now that the place is online, maybe he'll be too busy to drink. We can only hope. Anyway, here we are. Derek led the way to a large, imposing Narn who was at that moment in conversation with a younger member of the same species, Caitlin's classmate Jacron, in fact, Griffin noticed as they approached. Ambassador Jakar, said Derek. Excuse me for interrupting. I wanted to introduce the IPO chief. Jakar did a double take at the sight of Bacon's companion, then put his fist to his chest and bowed in the Narn fashion before reaching out to shake Griffin's hand in both of his. Valor, he said. What a pleasant surprise. The decades have been kind. And to you as well, said Griffin, grinning. So it's ambassador now? I never figured you for the diplomatic type. Jakar smiled and made an airy gesture. We each serve as we are called, he replied enigmatically. May I introduce my nephew Jacron? But of course you have already met, Jakar said as if reminding himself. He is a classmate of your daughter's. Captain, said Jacron formally, thank you for arranging my transportation back to Narn next week. No trouble, Jacron, replied Griffin. Will you be joining Kate and the others at Satori Mandeville Memorial next term? Certainly, the young Narn replied seriously. With most of WPI's programs transferred intact, the engineers, whatever the new school decides to call us, will have a title to defend. Jacron's red eyes gleamed as he added, and there is always the possibility that we will be able to persuade Miss Tenjo to pitch competitively for us next season. Griffin chuckled. Good luck, he said. Thank you, sir. Where do you know Jakar from? Asked Derek as they moved on. And what was with that name he called you? Griffin shook his head, laughing softly at a memory. It's part of a very convoluted joke, said Griffin. You'd appreciate it, but this isn't the time.